And we're holding on Baba Kama, page 4, Ois Aleph. I have no idea why Ois Aleph isn't at the beginning, but so it is. Okay, so talking about the Ovis Nizikin, the Gemara gets into a whole discussion over the fact that, we know when a Shur Tam injures the first couple of times, or kills the first couple of times, then it's still considered a Tam. In the case where it injures an animal, then it pays on as you're paying only Chatzi Nezek, or once to the third time and on, then it's already Mu'ad, and then you have to pay Nezek Shalim. So the Gemara gets into a whole discussion about what's the nature of this Chatzi Nezek, is it Knas, is it Mamon, and it concludes that it's Knas, which means that only Dayanim, in Eretz Yisrael, who have the smicha ish mi piish, can judge such cases and not dayanim who don't, which is why nowadays, for example, we can't judge such diniknosis. However, again, the Gemara talks about that if, nevertheless, if a person in such a situation, so you have the Baal Din back then when they had smicha in Eretz Yisrael, but not in Bavel, then the Baal Din, the Nizik, could demand that we go to Eretz Yisrael to judge the case over there. And the Gemara mentions various other things that we do, and one of them is, the Gemara says, meanwhile, also we put the owner of the Mazik animal in Cherem until he gets rid of the danger. Because, the Gemara says, here's where we pick up the piece here in Ein Yaakov, Tanya, Rav Nosson, Omer. Rav Nosson says, Minayin Shalei Gadol Adam Kelev Ra B'Seich Beisei. How do we know that a person should not raise a dangerous dog in his house? Later in the Masechta, there's more detail about dogs and about the harm that they can cause, so a person is not allowed to do that. Or he's not allowed to have a rickety ladder standing in his house. And Marsha says that like this, you have, so Shanema, because Shanema, or Talmud Lema, because the Pasuk says you shouldn't place blood guilt in your house. The context is talking about putting up a mica around your roof so that nobody falls off. So by the same token, you have a responsibility to get rid of other such dangers as well. Marsha points out that you would think that maybe fine, as far as the mica, you have that. People in the household, they're going to go up to the roof all the time. Roofs in those times were very commonly used, so therefore that people might fall off. But you would think, as far as the dog, what's the big deal? The people, the members of the household are used to it, so it's not going to harm them. No, you're still not allowed to do that. And as far as the rickety ladder, the same thing. People in the house are going to know that this ladder is not so sturdy, and they're not going to use it. Nevertheless, you're still not allowed to have it, because like Sosim Domim Vesechel. And before we talk about, is the issue only when these things might kill, or are we talking about even when they might only cause injury? Anyway, the point is, the Gemara says that therefore, so a person has a responsibility to keep such dangers away, and therefore, again, in the case where a person has a shur, that's tam, even though you can't force him in Bavel to pay chatzi nezek, but you can put him in cheirim until he gets rid of the danger.
Maybe because of other people that will come in?
Yeah, the pashtus is because of other people. The pashtus is because of guests. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Next, the Gemara goes on, so then the Mishnah goes on later on to talk about, now like this, you have a shur, and most other domestic animals are normally tam. Normally they're not dangerous. Sometimes you have one that gets particularly wild, and therefore you have it goes through the stages of being tam and mu'ad. But then the Mishnah describes that you have, there's a number of kinds of animals where even if a person keeps them as a pet, nevertheless they're still naturally wild, and therefore they're considered mu'adin, or they're always considered mu'ad, and one of them is a bar. What a baudelus is, there's a variety of different explanations among Mephoshim, partly based on the fact that the Gemara identifies it by a number of different names. The Gemara also draws a distinction between a male and a female, so there's a number of different possibilities. Rashi himself gives two different explanations. Which one does the Mishnah mean? Which one is the Gemara saying that it means the male or the female? And on top of that, what kind of creature is a baudelus anyway? So Rashi on the Gemara brings that it's a type of creature called in English a polecat, which is a little creature similar to a skunk. Tosfos elsewhere objects that we find in some places that a bardalus is a big, dangerous, vicious creature, not like a little thing like that. So therefore, Tosfos has some other possibilities. It may be some kind of dangerous snake. One of the names that the Gemara gives over here for it is Ofa, which is like the word Efer, which is a particularly dangerous type of snake, a viper or something. Other possibilities are that it's a leopard or a cheetah or some kind of big cat like that. Another positive. Rambam gives a translation in Arabic that's a hyena. So there's a few possibilities what it is. The Tiferes Yisrael just says that, you know, you have in different contexts, sometimes a baudelus can mean that polecat, that little creature, and sometimes it means something more from the big cat family, like in the same family as lions and whatnot. Worth mentioning, by the way, in that connection, so the Gemara is saying that a lion is always considered wild, it can never be fully tamed. There's a sicha where the Rebbe talks about in that connection where we find Bilam compares the Jewish people, so the Rebbe talks about the idea based on that Mishnah. In other words, a lion, no matter how many, you may have had it for years and years as a pet, and you think it's completely innocuous, but then one day it wakes up and feels that it really is a lion after all, and it goes and does what lions do. And so it is with a yid also, no matter how long he may have gone, not even realizing that he's a yid, all of a sudden his pintle the yid wakes up and he bestirs himself and becomes the lion that he really is. So the Mishnah had mentioned the Baudlus, and the Gemara goes through a few different names for the creature. The Gemara asks, what is a Baudlus? And it gives one name. And then what does that mean? And it gives another name. And so forth. So the Gemara ends up explaining that actually what it is there's a transformation. These creatures transform from one type into another type. And therefore, so Rashi actually gives an explanation. That is why it goes by so many names, because in each metamorphosis, it has a new name. So Tanya, we learn in Braisa, Savoya Zohar, a male Savoya, which is another name for this creature, La'acha Zayin Shonim Nasa Atalif. After 7 years, it becomes a bat. Now, what does that mean? Does the actual Savoya becomes a bat? So first of all, Marsha brings based on Rashi that what it means is the male one transforms after 7 years, as we're saying, the female meanwhile takes much longer. The Gemara here one of the things that we identify as Savoya as is an Efer, which is again a type of dangerous snake, a viper, and we find in other Gemaras that it takes 7 years for that creature to give birth. So therefore, so it doesn't transform, it doesn't metamorphose into another type until 70 years. In fact, Maharsha brings from a Rashi on a pasuk in Yeshaya that says that of this creature, there's actually only one male and one female in the world, and they give birth only once in every 70 years. So it becomes an atalif. So one possibility, I think Ben Yehoyada talks about, Ion Yaakov says similarly, what it means is, in other words, that fine, you know, eventually these creatures die and they decompose, and then Hashem makes that the dust and what's left of them transforms into, as then becomes a different kind of creature. The atalif bat after 7 years becomes another type of bat called an arpad. Now she explains an arpad is also a type of bat, but it's a different species. There are many different types of bats, after all. Arpad la'achazayin shonim nasa kimosh. After 7 years, that transforms into a kimosh, which is a type of thorny plant. 7 years later, that in turn turns into a choyach, which is another kind of spiky, dangerous plant. Choyach la'achazayin shonim nasa shed, and after another 7 years, it becomes a shed. So, Marshall explains, in other words, the symbolism is over here that everything always, you have a thing is always going to produce things like it. So therefore, so the Efer being a very dangerous kind, the worst kind of snake. So therefore, now it becomes the worst kind of flying creature, which is a bat. And then within that, you have two different kinds of bats, and then it becomes the worst kind of plant, namely a kimosh or a choyach. And eventually, it becomes a shed that's harmful. Different Mephoshim talk about different other symbolisms of this. One idea is, in other words, that the Yetzirah keeps on transforming himself. After a while, he comes to you in a certain guise, and after a while, you're wise to him, and you know to be careful of him. But not long after that, he transforms into something else, and you don't recognize him, and therefore he figures now he has a shot with you again. So the point is to realize all the various guises that he can come in. So there's that. There's also in different generations. Also, in every generation, the Yetzirah appears in different forms as well. Another thing, the Gemara says, Shedra shel Adam, a person's Shedra, a person's spinal cord, la'acha zayin shanim nasa nochash. After 7 years, after he's been buried, it turns into a snake, v'hu, v'hani mili de lekora b'moidim. However, that's only provided that he didn't bow by moidim. Then his spine will turn into a snake. Now, why is that? There's the idea like this. Tosfos explains, the Gemara elsewhere tells us that when you bow, you're supposed to bow The Gemara says gradually, like, you know, you or rather the other way around. You bow. The Gemara says suddenly, like a stick, like all of a sudden you knock down a stick. The same way when you bow all at once. When you get up, when you rise up from your bowing, it shouldn't be that just be that you jump back up. It should be that you rise up back gradually by Hashem's name, like a snake gradually rising. So therefore, so a person didn't do that. So therefore, midah kenegan midah, then he gets transformed into a snake. Tosfos also brings the point. Usually we have those etzem luz that that person is reconstructed from la'asid lavay. Here, when so here, if we're saying that his spine becomes a snake, then that's as much to say as he won't come alive by tchias amesin. Now Tosfos wonders then, but what's the logic? I mean, because of this, because he wasn't mukara by moedim, therefore not. Nonetheless, though, despite the fact that Tosfos wonders about it, the fact is that the Zohar does say this as well. That this person has no chelik on Abba, and the Maimorim, that explain basically the idea. The whole idea of bowing by Moedim, the whole idea of Hodah, is to recognize that there's levels of Alakus that are beyond us. There's Hodah that you have from the, there's two different kinds of Hodah it talks about. There's where you recognize the greatness of the Eivishter, and then you realize that you're bottle to him, and then you have levels that you can't even recognize. So if a person doesn't even have that basic idea that that the Eivishter is greater than him, then what is he going to come alive? But Chesa Mason, and therefore we're saying that, therefore the Zohar is saying that he may not. Marshall also adds the point, in other words, that here you have that a person is supposed to, a person will naturally, so like this, you have like this, the Nochash was also supposed to walk upright, and here you have the Nochash instead was made to crawl on his belly. But now a person also walks upright. He has to be careful not to have gaiva. He has to be careful not to think that he doesn't depend on the Eivishter. So when he recognizes that he depends on the Eivishter, and therefore he bows properly in Shemoneh Esrei, then good. He'll come alive by Tzchias Amesin. But if not, in effect, what he's doing is he's acting like the Nochash HaKadmoni, and therefore he's going to end up as a Nochash himself, is what Maharshal says. There's other points as well. Rabbi Yonis and Eibishitz makes the point in Yadis Drash. He says another point is as well. The snake, Eibishitz told him, "V'ofer toichol kol yimei chayecha." You're going to eat dust your entire life. So here now, a person should be bowing himself in nafshi ka'ofer la'koltia by Shemoneh Esrei, and particularly by Moedim, again, where we're acknowledging the greatness of Hashem. And if he doesn't, then we're saying he winds up being a nachash. Further on, the Mishnah talks about, now, so you have a difference between a shur tam and mu'ah. The Mishnah points out, is besides the fact that with a shur tam you pay chatzi nezek, and with a shur mu'ah you pay nezek shalem, another distinction is, the Mishnah says, with a shur tam you pay only migufay. The amount you're going to pay, not only it's capped at only half the nezek, but within that it's also capped at the value of the shur. So if you have your shur tam caused $500 worth of damage, and chatzi nezek then would be $250, but the shur itself is worth only $200, then that's it. The other guy can collect only $200. As opposed to, the Mishnah says, if it was a shur muad, then you pay min ha'aliyah. So then it means you pay min ha'aliyah, meaning you pay from the best of your property, meitav sadehu, as the pasuk says it. So the Gemara discusses what it means, min ha'aliyah, and it means from the best quality, and that leads the Gemara into the following discussion, where also we find that the word mala means the best quality. Pasuk says, Vayishkav Chizkiyahu imavoy. So Chizkiyahu passed away, he slept with his fathers, meaning that he passed away and his neshama went to Gan Eden together with his ancestors, the previous kings. Vayitburuhu b'malei kivrei b'nei David. And they buried him, the Pasuk is saying, in the mala of the graves of b'nei David. So what does that mean? What's b'mala? V'omer Abelazer, b'mala means etzel ma'ulim shebe mishpacha. Means they buried him next to the highest quality people of that family. U'man ninu, David ishleimer. Namely, they buried him next to David and Shlomo. So they had, there was an area in Yerushalayim where they had all the kivarim of Malchi Beis David. The Mishnah, by the way, elsewhere says, B'chlal, they weren't allowed to bury people in Yerushalayim, with the exception of, you have the graves of Malchi Beis David, and you had also the cave of Chul B'Hanaviyah. Those were the exceptions to the rule, although all other burials had to take place outside Yerushalayim. Ad Kedekach, we know in the story of the Churban, Rabbi Yechonon Zakkai is able to pretend that he's dead, and so that they'll take him out of Yerushalayim, because even the Biryonim respected that concept that you can't bury in Yerushalayim. Incidentally, by the way, during the Israeli War of Independence, during the siege of Yerushalayim in 1948, there came a point when they weren't able to do that attack. The Jordanians and all are besieging them, so they had no choice but to temporarily, the Rabbonim of Yerushalayim of that time allowed people who had been killed in the bombings, people who had passed away of whatever causes, they had them, they had a temporary area to bury them inside the walls, inside the old city, because they had no choice. Afterwards, they reburied them outside the city. Adi Yemazeh, you can go, there's an area over there in the old city, there's a little tiny corner over there in Bate Machsa neighborhood, you can go over there and they have there a little memorial in memory of those people. Anyway. So again, so they buried Chizkiyahu Davka in the area of that Beis HaKvaris by Dovid and Shlomo. Now, why do they do that? Marsho refers to a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says in Chizkiyah's times there was a fellow named Shevna. This Shevna, we find one pasuk describes him as Asher Alaboyis, that he was in charge of the palace. He's like Chizkiyahu's chief of staff. A different place refers to him as Shevna HaSofer. Tosfos elsewhere discusses, is that the same person? Maybe he had two different jobs. Whatever the case, the Gemara explains in Sanhedrin, he was a big Yedeah Sefer. He was very knowledgeable in Torah. In fact, he had more Talmidim and more followers even than Chizkiyahu did. But he was a Rosha, and he was trying to betray Chizkiyahu and went and go. That time Sancheirev is besieging Yerushalayim. And Shevna had plans to go out and surrender himself and all of his men to Sancheiriv and tell them we're on your side and we're going to help you overthrow Chizkiyahu, and therefore Shevna figured he'll make himself king. So in fact, he actually went. So the Navi Yeshaya criticizes him at that point. Shevna went and had for himself dug out a caver in that area of Malchut Beis David, figuring that after he's eventually going to be king under Sancheiriv's protection, and then eventually he'll be buried there. And the Navi goes and harshly criticizes him for it. Malachapoy, Milachapoy, what are you doing making for yourself a cave over here? In the end, you're going to go in Golos and you're going to be buried and you're going to end up dying and being buried in a very degrading way. They found, by the way, interestingly, they found in digs, in archaeological digs in that part of Yerushalayim, they found a burial cave that had a name written on it, but half of the name has been hacked off. You have the end of it that says something Yahu, but you know, can't tell what the beginning of the name is. They think maybe that was this very grave that Shevna, maybe Shevna is short for Shvan Yahu or something, and maybe Taka, that would be the thing he dug out for himself. Echi, yeah, the point is that now, so in the end, Taka Shevna, the Gemara tells over there how in the end, he was arrested by Sancheirev and dragged around and everything, and he tacked die a very ignominious death. So now, when Chizkiyahu eventually, years later, passed away, they didn't want to use that same caver that Shevna had carved out, the Rosha. So instead, they buried Chizkiyahu near the highest ranking people of Malchut Beis David, namely David and Shlomo. So that would be why they did that. Another point as well, is because Eitz Yosef points out, the Gemara tells us also in Sanhedrin that Chizkiyahu promoted the study of Torah among the people of his kingdom, among the kingdom of Yehuda, more so than any king before him, going all the way back to David and Shlomo. So the Chub al Oil Mepnei Shaman, the Gemara says, the yoke of Sancheira was broken and destroyed because of the oil that they had spending nights in the Bate Medrash and learning Torah. Kedekach, the Gemara says, even the little kids in Eretz Yehuda at that time were thoroughly familiar with the halachas of Tumah V'Tahara, all the complicated things. So therefore, Chizkiyahu gets tremendous credit for spreading Torah among the Jewish people, and therefore, in that sense, he's most like David and Shlomo. They built the Beis Mikdash, and he, with his promotion of Torah learning, preserved the Beis Mikdash so and get destroyed by Sancheirev. So therefore, he deserves to be buried next to them. So that's what it means. So when it says b'male, so we see that the word b'male means in the highest quality place, and therefore, the same way when the Mishnah says that the owner of a shor mu'ad has to pay minhaliyah, then it also means from the best of his property. Speaking of how they buried kings of Yehuda, so the Gemara focuses on another pasuk about an earlier king. You have King Asa, about 200 years before Chizkiyahu. The pasuk says, "Vayiruhu b'kivroys v'ashakar alay be'ir David." They buried him in his burial place that he had dug for himself in the city of David, again in the plot for the kings. "Vayashkivuhu," and so the pasuk is saying they laid him to rest b'mishkav asher mile b'samim uznim, in the burial place, in the lying down place, which he had previously filled up with spices and znim, says about Asa. So my besomim was znim. So what does that phrase mean? Rebbe Eliezer Omer, zni zni. So Rabbi Eliezer says it means different kinds. The word zni, zoni, whatever, means different kinds. It actually points out the word l'minehu in Parshas Bereishis is translated l'znoihi. So the word zni, zni, or zoni, zoni, or however you pronounce it, means different kinds of spices. Why would he have done that? Marsha points out, the Pasuk tells us about Asa that 2 years before he passed away, he had a terrible disease in his feet. The Gemara in Sota tells us that at one point, a few years earlier in the middle of his kingship, he had at one point, there was an emergency project, an emergency government building project for which he drafted everybody, including Tamil Chachamim, and for that, eventually, he was punished with a disease in his feet. So now, therefore, the vote would be, so he needed various spices and various ointments and things like that to make his feet feel better. So now, therefore, so they put some of them in his grave as well, like to accompany him to the Olam Emes, so to speak. So there's that. Yom Yaakov also adds the point that the Pasuk says that during those 2 years of his illness, he didn't spend enough time davening to be healed from it. Instead, he was going from one doctor to the next for them to cure him. So now, after he passed away also, then the doctors also did chanita. They did like embalming for him, and therefore they used spices, and therefore there were a bunch of spices in his grave. So that's one explanation. Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni, Omer, Besamim, Shkolam, Riach, Bahem, Bali, Gei, Zima. Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni explains the word uznim means, it's related to the word znus. So these are the kinds of spices that have such an overpowering fragrance that anybody who smells them, it gives them thoughts of znus, thoughts of zima. So there, that's another meaning of uznim. So basically, in other words, the machlokes just is what's more important, the quality or the quantity. Rav Elazar is focusing more on the quantity, the number of different types, and Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni is focusing more on the quality that they had such an overpowering, intoxicating fragrance. Since we're mentioning a machlokes between Rav Elazar, it says over here Rav Eliezer, it's supposed to be Rav Elazar, really. Since we're mentioning a machlokes between Rav Elazar and Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni in the meaning of a pasuk, then the Gemara digresses to mention another machlokes in an argument about psukim between them, which also actually comes up in a matter of Zoyna. And then the Gemara will get back to the burials of the kings of Yehuda. So the Yumi at one point is complaining to the Eibishter how he has those various people who are harassing him and trying to kill him, trying to stop him from saying Nevuah, all kinds of things. So he has an expression, Ki choru shucha l'lochdeni, they've dug a pit to trap me. Ufachim tomnu l'raglai, and they've hidden snares and traps for my feet. So the metaphor is, in other words, like you want to trap a wild animal, you dig a pit in the ground, and then you put a trap nearby, so the animal will get snared in the trap, and then it'll fall into the pit. So Yumi is saying they're doing the same kind of thing to me. So what does this mean? They didn't literally set traps for him, and they did eventually, they did put him into a pit, that the Gemara is going to point out in a few lines, but what is he saying by this? So Rav Elazar Omer Shechashdu Mizoyna. Rav Elazar says it means that they suspected him, or claimed to suspect him, of being involved with a Zoyna. Now, Tosfos points out, Yumi is a Kohen. A Kohen is also to have relations with a Zoyna. So therefore, so they're claiming falsely against him that he's doing that. Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni says it wasn't just a Zoyna, they were suspecting him of having relations with an Eishes Ish. Now, Marsha points out, so why dafka were they doing this to Yumi? We find the Medrash said, we find something similar. They did the same kind of thing to Moshe Rabbeinu back in the day. They also claim, the Gemara says that people were mekane to their wives and saying, don't be alone with Moshe because we suspect him. So the point is, Marsha says, both Moshe and Yeshua were both, they were both prepared for Nevuah from a long time. Moshe is on call all the time. Imdu v'eshma ma'itzav Hashem lachem, like he says to the people who asked him about Pesach Sheni. Yumi also, Hashem tells him, I made you ready to be a Novi already when you were in the womb. So, and the Medrash, in fact, mentions a lot of similarities between Moshe and Yeshua, one of them being that their careers as Navi both lasted for 40 years. So what happened was, now with Moshe Rabbeinu, we know famously he separated from Tzipora. That was the whole thing that Miriam said Lashon Hara about him, etc. Yumi also had to be always on call. So therefore, he's also separated from his wife. In fact, you have a postif, in Marsha doesn't mention, but you actually have a postif in Sefer Yumi, where Hashem tells him, don't get married, don't have children here in Eretz Yisrael, because then when the Churban comes, then they're going to be swept up in it. So anyway, so therefore, so he's not together with his wife. So therefore, people are claiming how can he be away from his wife for so long? Must be that there's a zoner or an eshesish involved. So that would be the excuse that they use. And different other mafoshim talk about different other reasons why Dafka they would have suspected him of that. Whatever the case, the point is, so the two different opinions. Are they claiming a zoina or they're claiming an eshesish? So the Gemara says, "Bishleim lamando amashachash dumi zoina." Well, according to the opinion that they suspect that he's with a zoina, okay, then that explains the phrasing that he uses. That he says, "Kicharu shucha lalachdeni." The same way as we have an expression in the Pasuk in Mishlei that a zoner is like a deep pit. Meaning, again, you know, a person falls into a deep pit. He's not getting out of it so easily. The same way if a man gets involved with a zoner, then it tends to take over his life. So that would explain why Yumi is also using the word shucha. But if you say that it was an eshesish, my shucha, why particularly is he using the figure of speech of a shucha? And the answer is, well, if also Eshesish mi nafka meklal zoina, listen, if an Eshesish was to be Mizana, then she's also in the category of a zoina. So therefore, in other words, the opinion of Shmuel Nachmeni is saying the Eshesish is saying a specific type of zoina. Not a zoina as in mufteres, but a zoina as in a woman who's having relations that would make her consider in halacha a zoina, which definitely includes an Eshesish. The Gemara continues. Now we can ask the other way around. If you say that they were suspecting and claiming that he's involved with an Eishas Ish, thus we find the next pasuk continues. Hashem, you know all their plots against me that they're trying to kill me. Because if they're claiming he's with an Eishas Ish, means in other words they're saying he's Chayiv Chenek or Skila or whatever the exact situation is. So then in that case, so we can say then that so he's complaining that they're trumping up charges against me and they're trying to get me Chayiv Misa. But if you're saying they're only suspecting him with a zoina, fine, he's a Kohen, he's also to marry a zoina. Fine, maximum he'd get for that is Malkus. There's no ways the Lamoves in there. And the answer is Sheshul Be'er Tit. According to that, he's not complaining that they're trying to kill me as in that with this particular accusation that they're making against me. We find in Sefer Yirmiyah that at one point his enemies had him thrown into a pit full of mud and he almost sank in there and drowned and they had to schlep him out there with ropes at the last moment. So that's what he's complaining to the Eibishter that people they're trying to do that to him. So according to that, that Sosam all of Amavis is not directly related to what he said that they're suspecting me of being involved. Involved with a zoina. So in this connection, Dorash Rava, so Rava further darshens, my duchtiv, what does it mean? The Yirmiyah continues over there after he's complaining to the Eibishter about what his enemies are doing to him. He says, V'yu mukhsholim lefanecha, may they be made to stumble before you, be'es apcha asebohem, in the time of your anger, act against them. So what specifically is he asking for in the words V'yu mukhsholim lefanecha? So it means Omer Yirmiyah lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu means that Yirmiyah is asking Hashem about them, Ribono Shel Olam, afilu b'shar she'osin tzedakah, even when these people, his enemies, are trying to do tzedakah. Now Rashi brings a girsa, by the way, that there was a girsa b'shar she'yisrael osin tzedakah. It's not here in Ein Yaakov, but it's in the Gemara. Rashi brings a girsa that it's b'shar she'yisrael osin tzedakah. Rashi says no, because Yirmiyah over here is not talking about the Jewish people generically. He's talking specifically about the people of Anosos, which is his own hometown. There were people from his own hometown who were against him and were saying, let's try to get him to stop saying Nevuah and even kill him and even do whatever it is to take, if necessary, to get him to stop. So now he's saying, even when those people want to give tzedakah, hachshilen b'vnei adam, she'enim mehuganim, cause them to stumble over that they're going to end up giving tzedakah to people who are not worthy. Kadesh shelo yekabla aleim schar, so that they don't get a schar for giving them tzedakah. Actually it's Tosfos that says that we know that what the Gemara says, not Yisrael. But where do we get that? So Tosfos says, because since he's saying, V'yu mukhsholim lefanecha, so we have the same word v'holach lefanecha tzidkecha. We had an after a few days ago, an after of Yom Kippur morning, there was the expression, v'holach lefanecha tzidkecha, your tzedakah will walk before you to lead you to Gan Eden. So therefore we see the word lefanecha refers to tzedakah. So Yumi is saying, even when they're trying to do lefanecha, when they're trying to do tzedakah, nevertheless, v'yom mukhsholim, let them stumble in that, and they end up giving to people who don't deserve the tzedakah, and that way they don't get a sky for it. Maharshal says another vote as well. Yumi is saying, Be'ez apcha sevahem. When you're angry at them, then act against them. Now, tzedakah has the ability, the Gemara tells us in Bava Basra, to keep away Hashem's anger. So therefore, said Nezu, matan b'seisa yich ba'af, the Gemara brings over there from Pasuk and Mishlei, that a gift of tzedakah in secret turns away Hashem's anger. Well, then, very well. Yumi is saying over here, they should end up doing it in a way that won't turn away Hashem's anger because the recipients won't be worthy of tzedakah anyway. So, an interesting point in that regard, first of all, there's an explanation from Rav Yochanan Wasserman that says that you can have, now you consider, a person might be motivated to give tzedakah, l'shem shamayim, and then the Eibishter is not going to hold it against him, even if it turns out that the person is unworthy. In fact, there's a Gemara in Ksubas that says, in a way, we should be grateful to the ramoyim, to the cheaters who sometimes end up collecting tzedakah on false pretenses, because otherwise, every time we refuse a poor person tzedakah, we'd be in trouble. Are you talking? A poor person is asking for tzedakah and you're not giving him. At least this way it gives us a shtickle excuse that we can say, I thought this guy was a ramai. But at least, so if you're giving tackle l'shem shamayim, then the Eibishter is not going to hold it against you that it turns out the recipient was a ramai. Vice versa, if you give, even if it wasn't for whatever pnia, but it turns out the guy was worthy, then also you might get a schar for that. But here, Yumi is saying, I know they're not giving tzedakah l'shem shamayim, so the only thing is, at least if they're giving to people who deserve it, so make sure that the people who they end up giving it to don't deserve it, and that way they don't get any schar at all. With that said, though, there's a chassidish vort on it that also says that, on the other hand, I mean, what kind of a thing is that for Yumi to say against fellow Jews? So fakir, the vort is, he's saying, make it that they end up giving tzedakah to people who are not worthy. And that in turn, by you, the Eibishter, that should evoke, midah k'neged midah, that you'll also give them schar and you'll also help them even if they're not worthy. So almost turning this whole point on its head, kind of, and then malam and tzchus on them, yeah. It's interesting, by the way, there's other places in Sefer Yumiya where he speaks very harshly against the people of Anoses, and they should die young, and they shouldn't have children and grandchildren eventually because of the way they're treating him. Nevertheless, though, we find in Sefer Ezra that when the Jewish people came back to the 50-odd years and 70-odd years after the Churban to build the second Beis Hamikdash, then it mentions over there, Anshei Anoses, it mentions there were people from Anoses. So the vote was, they eventually did tshuva, and therefore, so now all of these things that Yumiya was davening against them, never happened because they did tshuva and they turned the Eibishter's anger against them to rachamim. Okay, so getting back now to Chizkiyahu, we said that when they buried him, they gave him tremendous cover, and they buried him next to David and Shlomo. So now the pasuk continues also by Chizkiyah. It says v'chavod asuloi b'moisai. They did honor for him when he passed away. So what does that mean? What's the special cover that it says by him that it doesn't say by anybody else? Melamed Shoyeshivu Yeshiva Al Kivrei. That teaches us that they set up a yeshiva by his grave, a kavod el Torah. So therefore, they showed him the ultimate kavod by having a yeshiva. Talmidim who are going to be osek b'Torah. Now, Tosfos discusses that it may not, first of all, the reason for it is, again, because he did so much to promote knowledge of Torah among the Jewish people, so therefore they wanted to give him that extra honor. However, Tosfos says it still can't have been right by his kever, because you have the problem of loyeg l'rosh, the same principle as you have why you can't wear tzitzis out, for example, by a kever, because it's like making fun of the mess, how we can do mitzvahs and you can't. So it has to be, Tosfos says, that it would have been four amos away. On the other hand, there's a parenthetical note put in Tosfos over here, from the Nemuka Yosef on the Rif that brings in the name of the Rama, that no, it's only like this, for example, you have, if you're going to be learning Torah of your own, you're going to just be learning Torah for the sake of learning by a kever, then you have a problem of Loyeg L'Rosh. But here they're doing it for the covered of, here they're doing it for the covered of Chizkiyah, so therefore there's not a problem. There's not an issue of Loyeg L'Rosh, and they could be tackled doing it directly by the kever. What?
What about Tumah for a Kohen?
Tumah for a Kohen, so okay, Kohen wouldn't be there, obviously.
But saying that four
amos is enough? So Tosfos is saying four amos is enough. But again, the Nemuka Yosef is saying that maybe you don't even need that. It could even been Davka by the Kaver itself because they're doing it for his covered. The Riaf over here, the printed under the name Harif here on Ein Yaakov, also says the word that because they're talking about they're doing they're doing his own chidushim, the Torah that he himself had taught and promoted among the Jewish people. And again, even the children were familiar with Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara in his times. So therefore, so it could even be, maybe then we could say that it was even by the Keter itself. Now, how long did this last? Pligi Rab Nosson and Rabbanan. The Rab Nosson and the Chachamim argue how long they did that. Chadom Gimel, one says they had it 3 days after he was buried. V'chadom Zayin, another one says 7. V'ami Lo Lamed, others say that it was 30. These are Taka. You have when it comes to Avelos. See, these are different stages of Avelos. The Gemara tells us in Moed Katan, you have 3 days for crying, 7 days for a lesser degree of Avelos, 30 days for even less than that. So therefore, so that's how they did in the same, and these represent progressive stages in how the Neshama withdraws from Olam Hazeh. So therefore, according to these various opinions, they have the yeshiva there for that amount of time in for his covered. Here, by the way, we're saying that it was for Chizkiah, that Rambam actually tackled when he brings in Hilchos Malachim. He says they would do this for all the kings. So that Rambam apparently understands it wasn't something unique to Chizkiah because of what we're saying, because of his accomplishments in spreading Torah among the Jewish people, but rather that Rambam would learn that this is a regular thing that they did for all the kings, and it just mentions it punked by Chizkiah. So the Gemara will continue. Afterwards with other meanings of a chavod asalad b'moise, more ways in which they showed him covered by his funeral, and then after that.
That's going to be the next year.
The next year will be, I guess, Thursday night, Be'ez Hashem. Second night of family. So according to the Rambam, it's all maybe. So according to the Rambam, it's all kings from Beis David. Yeah. Yom Yom Mashiach HaGa'ola, Yom Gimel Tishrei, today having been the Yom Hilulah of the Rebbe Maharash. A story involving the Rebbe Maharash, that the Mitzvah of the Rebbe, not the Mitzvah of the Rebbe, the Friedrich Rebbe once told a story that the Rebbe Maharash used to, every weekday he would go for a spatzir, he would go for a ride in his carriage. So one time he's going on a different route than usual, all the local goyish peasants came out, and they were all bowing in front of him. And people asked him, where does that come from? And, well, who do you think it says about? Baruch Tia, Mikol Amim, you'll be blessed by all the other nations. So the Rebbe once explained in a mimer, therefore, the whole purpose of a person being created is to make a dira b'tachtonim, and now we're in the last generations before the Geula, so we have to finish making that dira. So that's accomplished in the way a yid will serve the Eibishter in such a way that even these low class goyim will recognize the greatness of a yid and bless him. So that means every yid is given an asinus koyach for that. And then the Rebbe goes on and says that is in fact why the Friedrich Rebbe told the story and said that we should be mefarisim in order to add an asinus koyach that every yid should realize for that. We realize first of all it happened by Anossi, and Anossi Rakol, it means it also gives a special koyach to every individual yid. Because it was publicized through a Nasi, so it means that every yid has the ability to do that, to do his avoda in such a way that even the lowest of the low goyim will realize how great a yid is and how close he is to the Eidoshet. So being more of what a yid should be, the more a yid is what he should be, as the Friedrich, the Rebbe Maharash being the highest example of that, then the more the goyim realize that it's something they have to respect also, yeah. A couple of halachas about sukkahs. One thing is when you make the walls of the sukkah, you can't have that the wind can't be moving them. So a lot of times people make, for example, canvas sukkahs. That's not necessarily such a good thing because the walls do move around and flap in the wind. So if you have that, then you have to have. Also with the pop up sukkahs, for example, it comes up. So what you can do is you make enough walls, at least in the lower 10 tefachim, that aren't going to move. You have, for example, you may put over there pieces of wood, you may put over there vertical poles, you may put over there horizontal ropes wrapped around the beams of the sukkah or whatever in such a way that they won't move. And then if the rest of the wall above that is made of canvas, then it's not as big a deal. That's the Ruach Metzuria, fine, but the canvas or whatever is going to move around in Ruach Metzuria as well, yeah.
The movement should be drastic,
no? No, that's the thing. I guess they talk about that it may be okay because after all they do basically stay in place. They just move back and forth, but better to avoid the issue. Then you have the schach, among other things, can't be held in place with davar hamakabel truma. So one practical thing is, for example, that you can't tie down your schach with zip ties, for example. So you can put on them. You can put on them. For example, you can put 2x4s on them. 2x4s in and of themselves are a kosher schach. You just can't make the whole schach out of them because of zeras tikra. But you can hold the schach down with those, for example.
I'm sorry, is it 2x4s you said?
I don't know if 2x4, maybe 2x4s are too big for the purpose, but at least they're thinner ones, at least, yeah.
I would say to just use twine, because it's made out of...
The twine, so if you have a twine, that's made out, if you have like hemp twine or whatever, then yeah, that's specific. Yeah, so then that would also work for the purpose, yeah. The same way, for example, you have the mats nowadays, which are also, they're twined together with bamboo twine or whatever it is, that's also, yeah.